Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, where we are teaching people the power of ethical only persuasion. They get rid of all this unethical talk. It's created the altered states of America. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques. Jump in and learn some rhetoric. I'm Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, rhetoric PhD, escaped professor. I'm also a stand-up comedian and comedy writer from late night in Hollywood. Here's a few jokes. You can find these if you go to Twitter. We're all over social media at Rhetoric War or Rhetoric Warriors. Try to find either one. A couple of recent jokes. We are one day within 24 hours of transitioning over to Biden when we're recording this. And there are going to be some differences in the outgoing and incoming administrations. Like, one thing I've noticed is their VP, the GOP's VP, looks like a vampire with a fly on his head. The new GP or VP wears chucks and line dances with little black girls. So there's a clearer brand difference. Some people are trying to make it pass some laws so that no national sites can be named after Trump because they don't want to see Trump's name anywhere, which I totally disagree with. I mean, just listen to how good it sounds. Trump National Landfill. That would be awesome. People would actually come to the landfill. And, you know, it's America. We need new ideas. So I think, how about we just vote for how much money each person can have? Like, it's not communism. I just proposed that Jeff Bezos can only have $37,000 per year in his bank account at any time. That's it. Let's vote. Let's make it happen. So this is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, where I convert conservatives. Lots of fun doing that. I talk to comedians about their politics, interesting brains, and I glean cool stuff from persuasion pros, which is what we're going to do this week. Visit us at rhetoricwarriors.com. Sign up for one of the courses. Just launched my new course, Converting Conservatives. Change the world by converting one conservative at a time. Literally, if liberals, like 80 million people voted for Biden, if everybody just targeted one conservative and you got 20%, there'd be 100 million people voting next time the GOP's gone. Just saying. So take a course from us over there. My guest this week, God, we've known each other how long?
Long time, 40 years?
40 years, like when you add it all up, yeah. We went to grad school together, UT Austin. David McLennan is a professor now at Meredith College. We were also faculty together at a small all-female Presbyterian college in the South named Peace College. Interesting experience that was. Dave is a rhetorician, even though he doesn't claim it anymore on his bio. We're going to talk about that. He's a traitor, rhetorical traitor. Now says he does political science, which he does. David's always done political science. It's always been his career interest, his academic interest. And so he lives in North Carolina, understands North Carolina politics. We're going to delve. Everybody, welcome Dr. David McLennan.
Dan, good to be with you. Great to catch up with you after this many years. You haven't changed at all.
Yeah, I try, but I can't seem to get any alteration into my basic personality. We were roommates for a year.
Yeah, that was an interesting year. I mean, we went through lots of things. We had a next door neighbor who was arrested for doing child porn. Had my car stolen from the parking lot,
and yeah, that was just same apartment. That apartment was crazy. He got arrested for pedophilia.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you got interviewed by the news about how well we knew him, and yeah. I forget what you said, but like, he seemed nice to his dog. I mean,
yeah, that's what I said. He had a big dog, and they put that on the news. That me saying, yeah. Well, he had a big dog.
That tells you about the news industry in this country. So.
Yeah, just somebody's got to say something. Size of the dog, good enough. And I'll never forget the day when you walked in. He's like, did I park my car somewhere else?
Yeah, I did. Remember, they found it at the bottom of a lake.
Did they really?
Yeah, the Austin PD called me and said, I've got good news and bad news. The good news is we found your car, and the bad news is it's at the bottom of a lake. And they charged me the towing fee to get it out of the lake.
How do you They can't do that.
This is 1986 in Austin. I think they can do whatever they want.
Is that what drove you into politics? This kind of, you know,
well, the funny follow-up to that is I got called for jury duty one time here in North Carolina. It was an auto theft case. And so they're doing voir dire. And so the prosecuting attorney said, well, has anybody had their car stolen? I raised my hand. And so he started asking me questions. Well, what do you think of how the police handled it? So I told that story. Needless to say, I didn't make that jury.
Yeah, I've been called for jury duty like 7 times and never, ever made it to the actual trial.
Well, I tell my students it's one of the things they ought to do. And so finally, I got my chance to be on a jury because usually I don't make it. And it happened to be a child molestation case. So be careful what you wish for. Oh. It was brutal. It was one of the most brutal times. And anyway, so yeah.
Well, tell us your background a little bit. I ran it a little, but you know, you got a PhD in a cognate area, it says on here, cognate and rhetoric. I don't know what a cognate area is. Cognate area, politics.
Yeah, so related. So it's a career trajectory that sounds more interesting than it really is, but taught rhetoric for a number of years. Dan and I taught together, as he mentioned. Then what happened at most small colleges was that students became consumers and they wanted, instead of rhetoric, they wanted different kinds of communication, organizational communication, PR, things that I couldn't comfortably teach. And I found that by the time I got to Meredith, I was doing applied communication within the field of politics. So I had done about 12 years of having a nonprofit in which I recruited and trained women to run for office. And really all I taught them was how to message and had a very successful run at that. And so I found that even though I teach within political science, I'm really teaching students how to message effectively, because whether you're in electoral politics or you're working in government or you're in a nonprofit, it's really about messaging. So I really found that what I'm teaching, even though it has a different kind of shingle on the front of it, it's really very, very similar to what I was doing when I was a straight rhetorician.
Well, and I've always run into this out, you know, in the real world, where I don't have the cloak of academics around me, and people run into me and they ask what I do and what my background is. And I say rhetorician, and I have all sorts of versions of it, but master rhetorician, you know, sneaky rhetorician, you know, they're like, what's that? Like they never even heard that it's a real, like, they don't believe it's a real PhD, right? They're like, yeah. What's your PhD in? I'm like, rhetoric. I'm like, that's not real. And then, you know, it gives me that open opportunity to be like, oh, well, it seems like the Greeks knew it was real 2,500 years ago when it was taught in their primary education, you know, and they're like, really?
Well, it's so interesting that in my career, other disciplines have discovered rhetoric, political science being one of them, sociology, many other disciplines.
Yeah, plundered it, try to come in and take, you know,
well, they think they've invented it.
Yeah, exactly.
So they take this ownership. So when I go to academic conferences, I tend to go to the political communication division of political science conference. And it's so interesting. They do everything but study message. And I'm going, you call yourself communication, but yet they really are just doing surveys of people.
Yeah, they're doing target analysis, right?
Target analysis, yeah. And so I was talking at a conference, I was a critic on a panel of one of these big names in that field, and he was presenting his work. And I said, you know, this might come across as heresy, but maybe if you looked at the message, you'd learn a little bit more. And he didn't really appreciate that comment.
Yeah, it's interesting though. Like, I took a wide range of courses in my PhD because it was a new PhD program, and there was really only one rhetorician on staff, you know, David Payne, who's great. I learned a lot from him, enjoyed his classes, but so I would go around the university and just grab things. And I took a sociology of work course, which was great. The guy was an awesome ethnographer. But I remember one time came in all excited one day, and he's like, this is one of my favorite lectures. He goes, you know, and so it's the sociology concept of labeling theory, that if you put a word on something, you know, that people see it through the words, you know, and I'm like, hey, hold on. That's called rhetoric. You can't just call it labeling theory.
Well, you and I used to have long conversations, usually in a bar, about, for a field that deals with communication, that we have used words so poorly to market ourselves. So that, you know, when you introduce yourself as a rhetorician and people go, what's that? You know, it is that same sort of thing. Like, how could they not know that? But on the other hand, it's like the rhetoric field has been so talking to one another instead of outwardly that it's a shame.
Yeah,
and there's a lot to be gained from theory. Yeah,
tons. And that's always sort of been my thing. Like, you remember this, like, come from working class in Kentucky, my very first reaction to all this stuff is, where have you guys been? You know, like, I need, people in Kentucky need this stuff. I can tell you that, you know, maybe you should try to get it out to the world. And even when I was talking to Rod Hart, you know, a few weeks ago on the podcast, I just had that feeling again of, here's a super smart guy. It's got so much to say, and he's only reached, you know, a few thousand people in his whole life.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a few people in the rhetoric field that have kind of transcended that, but you're right. There's so many good ideas.
Like who? Rod Hart's a rhetorician, like straight up rhetorician that has any type of public, you know,
I guess, you know, someone back in our day, Kathleen Jameson probably has.
Again,
some.
How many thousands of people even know who she is?
Yeah, you have to tune in to PBS, the news hour, to get her take on the world. But yeah, I mean, certainly as compared to some of the other, you know, you look in other fields where they're more common names, you know, even when astrophysicists get to be, you know, well-known like Stephen Hawking, you go,
where's the Stephen Hawkings of rhetoric? We need somebody to, you know, have some odd disease and, like, you know, be still be really smart. And yeah. It's it is an interesting challenge, because even calling this brand that I've built up Rhetoric Warriors, like, everybody with rhetoric, they've only heard, you know, the, you know, 1/10 of rhetoric, which is the unethical rhetoric, you know, the hollow rhetoric. It's just rhetoric, political rhetoric. And that's all they know from that word. So even that's why the slogan that I've got underneath the brand of ethical only persuasion, because people don't even know that's rhetoric, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's been so watered down, or, you know, thought of as nothing but just, you know, people think of it as BS, which is, you know, it's amazing around something like Martin Luther King Day, or, you know, as we think about what Joe Biden will say tomorrow, and people are saying he ought to quote Lincoln a lot, you know, the real power of ethical rhetoric. And then a day after the inauguration, people are going to be, I've forgotten about it.
Yeah.
It's just,
Well, that tradition, and, you know, the traditional political rhetoric of, you know, moralistic speeches and, you know, fairly high-handed and grandiose and elevated talk, it doesn't work in modern entertainment. And so there is a disjuncture there. But what I try to do a lot of times is pull people over to, like, so my background became entertainment very quickly. Like, I merged those things over there, because the thing about Trump that you have to give him is that he imported entertainment principles, reality show, into politics. And that had never been done. And it just blew everything open. And it's still not reset. Like, Biden, I read your thing in The Hill about, you know, Biden needs to talk, you know, and it sounds like more traditional calls to, like, FDR, I think it was, and maybe Lincoln, you know, calls to reconciliate and unify, very traditional rhetoric. And I'd be like, I don't know if that's going to work.
Well, that is a question for the Democrats, not just Biden. I mean, you've often heard that, you know, they were afraid to attack Trump, at least until this year, or fight on the same kind of playing ground as he fights on. Because I think you're right, is that he could brought entertainment and just sort of a, you know, 147 character attack on people that Democrats would try to refute with highfalutin kind of discourse. And so, you know, it'd be interesting to see what as I watch someone like AOC on the Democratic side, who has much better at social media, much better at the clapback, but still doesn't resort to the same sort of stuff that Trump does, you kind of go, yeah, that's kind of bringing it into the Democratic Party in a new way.
Yeah, you see a little freshness with it. I still think they need some really hardcore rhetoric training and modern, like this kind of very modernist, you know, entertainment rhetoric. Like they should put a really good shock comic, like a really good retort comic on staff. Like when Hillary tried to do it and called them basket of deplorables, I'm like, that's the worst writing I've ever heard for an insult. Like get a good writer.
Well, you know,
the
rumor is you know, that the historian John Meacham is assisting Biden with his speech, and you know, which, you know, it'll make it sound exactly like you're talking about the old rhetoric. You know, I'm wondering, someone who I follow a little bit, John Fugelsang, I'm sure you're familiar with him. You know, he's got that kind of, you know, even though he doesn't talk about rhetoric as a discipline, he's got that kind of approach. He gets up in people's faces in a way that makes you think, as opposed to just viscerally react.
Yeah, and I follow, like, if anybody, whoever's listening to this should go to my Twitter and even just go and follow the people I follow, because that's a very curated feed of people that talk about politics and who are really good writers, like very sharp, snappy, a lot of them are comedy writers, and they're not even professional comedy writers. It's just good, you know, really good at that sharp, quick, snappy line, which is what you need, because that's what fits in entertainment. And, you know, Trump was such a target. I'm like, who couldn't puncture that guy? You know, like, just bring in, you know, somebody to give you five lines and just hit him with it. Like,
Well, I don't know if you remember the speech that Obama gave at the Washington Press Club.
Yeah, he went after Trump, right? 13. Yeah.
I don't know who wrote, you know, who wrote that speech, because he had some of those lines like you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm sure it was just, you know, comedy writers from one of the late night shows probably.
Yeah.
And that's what you do. That's the sort of thing. You sit around all the time, you learn how to do that. So once you get a really hardcore, snappy line, there's no defense against it. And it will outlive that moment, as Trump proved, you know, it stays in the media. I wrote a joke once, every once in a while you write a joke in late night that leaps off your show and gets picked up and moved around the media. And it was when Pete Rose had come out and finally admitted that he bet on baseball. And the joke I wrote was, but still adamantly refuses to admit that he stole his hairstyle from a lesbian. And it was in Entertainment Weekly. I mean, it just sort of broke open for a while. And I got no credit for it because it came from the show. But that's the kind of stuff you need, where it's so potent. It just picks it perfectly. And it does some amazing things as a rhetorical artifact at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you think Biden is going to say? Do you think, I mean, I think Biden gives a good speech. He's obviously not as sharp as he was.
But no, I mean, I think people will walk away feeling comforted by his speech. You know, he's not going to drop the carnage word on them like Trump did 4 years ago. But, you know, it'll also be the kind of speech that it will not be any of the classics and political rhetoric kind of speech. I think what he'll do in the afternoon with his executive orders might be more significant.
Right?
I mean, he's going to drop, I think, 10 or 15 for the next 3 days.
Yeah, here comes the thunder.
Yeah. But, you know, he'll be competent. You know, maybe a gaffe or two, but it'll be Joe Biden.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, and, you know, he's in that unique position as a political candidate this time around, where he just needed to not be horrible. You know, his opponent, Trump, was so widely hated, had done so much, that anybody that just seemed rational and kind of, you know, reset the playing field kind of person was going to win.
I mean, I think his biggest applause line could be, I'm not going to be in your newsfeed 24/7.
The last 10 days, right? Without Trump on Twitter? Do you feel the silence?
I do. And it's just, you know, not only his feed, but everybody, you know, commenting and retweeting and just go, phew, it's been nice. And so why didn't Twitter think of this earlier?
I don't know. It's almost like somebody should have suggested it to him at some point.
Yeah,
it's fascinating. I mean, that interplay of politics and commerce that we're running into now. Like I said, Trump broke everything open, right? He started to use those social media platforms, you know, absolutely uninhibitedly. And nobody's ever had that kind of access to the American public.
No. And, you know, whether he was pushing one of his resorts or his hotels or his daughter's product line, you go, you know, not that anybody wants Joe Biden to do something like that, but you're right. You just got so used to it. And, you know, no matter what Joe Biden does, it's going to seem quiet and calm.
Well, and so, politics is supposed to be boring, right? Government is supposed to be boring.
Yeah. I mean, and Trump certainly, he can make the simplest thing the most dramatic, crap-filled event of all time. And you're going, okay, you know, signing a piece of legislation, unless it's the Civil Rights Act or something like that, is a pretty non-event. But yet, you know, his big flourishing Donald John Trump would be held up for the world to see. And, you know, I think it'll be, as I said before the election, I thought Trump's people are just getting tired of him. And because that kind of shtick, you can't carry on for forever. And so, you know, Joe Biden will bring us back to the more George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, even Barack Obama level of politics.
Yeah, I mean, entertainment is exhausting. That's the nature of entertainment. It can't have any dead air. If you're a reality show politician or reality show character, it's about constant conflict. There's never a let up, you know, and we, you know, the whole country, really the whole world is exhausted by that kind of politics, that merger. I understand why it was effective, but it has a lot of negative fallout that we're all going, you know, and the rhetoricians, to me, the rhetorical scholars and the academics still need to come to, you know, bear on this and be like, hey, you know, this may work, but look what it's going to do to the society.
Yeah, and I think there will be another Donald Trump in the future. And I think the rhetoric discipline has got to do a better job of what you're setting out to do, which is to be armed against that. Because I think for the first 2 years, people were just blown away and didn't know at all how to even process it. So, but I'm sure, not sure we've got our heads around it yet. And God forbid we have another one, but you know, it seems like a number of Republicans are certainly vying for the position.
Well, you and I were, you know, we're two of the most educated people on the planet, literally, about rhetoric. We both have a PhD in rhetoric. Never took anything in entertainment rhetoric. Like, how do you counter, you know, this type of, he imported business talk, you know, and he imported entertainment talk. And those are outside the political realm. And so you need a new set of responses and counter persuasion and diffusion and all that. We weren't, you know, rhetoric's not set up for that.
No, it's not. I mean, we still teach really in the same system that the Greeks did 2,500 years ago. Yeah. Logical proof. You know, there's certain types of emotional appeals you make and certain types you don't. And you're right. Trump blew that all out of the water. I mean, there was, you know, when he made the statement, or the statement was made of him, that he doesn't believe in words, that words are just simply vehicles. And that's so counter to what the whole tradition of rhetoric is, which is you own your words. That's part of your ethos. You go, wow. You know, I mean, for him, changing his mind in mid-speech has had no consequences to him.
Yeah, it's that blitzkrieg, you know, and I've laid out a lot of the rights techniques, the Trumpian MAGA techniques, trying to write up a playbook for it so that you can see what they are and figure out how to counter program it. But that, I call it that blitzkrieg rhetoric, you know, where you never stop. Like, there's no slow down position. Like, rhetoricians break things down slowly. You know, we slow it down, look at it, take it to its parts, find its allegiances to the past, you know, Lincoln and all this kind of stuff. which makes good sense, but that's not the environment of a blitzkrieg, you know, a rhetorical environment. They never will let you do that, you know.
And they're unconcerned that they'll change their strategy 2 seconds later. I mean, the one thing you can say about studying rhetoric of Lincoln or something like that is the remarkable consistency across time, and you could come up with patterns. And so we're trained to observe patterns, and there are no patterns in the kind of rhetoric you're talking about, which is just like, you know, I can insult somebody one day, ingratiate myself the next day, and go back to insulting the next day, and there's no cost to it.
Yeah, I think you're right. That idea of consistency, you know, it's the right counter programs to what's been. And that's a pretty easy dynamic, because everybody's always like, oh, like even Hart said this to me, that there's Trump has a genius to him. I'm like, no, he doesn't. Like, I worked in entertainment. All that is reactive talk. Like, whatever somebody says, you take a counter position to it. And if you said something one day, you take a counter position to yourself, because it's just counter positioning. And that technique creates conflict, creates variety. And those two elements are entertainment aesthetics. Constant variety and constant conflict. They're not, like you said, they are not traditional political aesthetics at all. So if you're going to run into that kind of rhetorician, get ready to counter program that, because just trying to stay with consistency. And you saw the left do this over and over again, like he lies all the time. I'm like, yeah, we got it.
You know? Yeah. I mean, the Washington Post cataloged, what, 30,000 lies. And you know, it came down to 44,000 votes. If it had gone the other way, even this year, he'd have been in the second term. So you're right that sort of, you know, response to Trump saying you lie is just insignificant. You know, the other sort of enabler is the journalism field, because they are also trained to follow up on conflict. So every time he did exactly what you said, which was create conflict, resolve the conflict, recreate the conflict, they're sitting there making it headline or lead tweet or whatever it may be. And, you know, despite 4 years of people saying, well, just don't cover him, it's almost like catnip to a cat. They couldn't stop themselves.
Yeah. And, you know, I have a background in journalism, undergrad in journalism, and worked in journalism a little bit here and there. And the reason I got out of journalism is that it's so programmatic. Like, it completely constricts your writing, and I hated it. Like, you can't say something that you know is obviously true. You know, you can't take a too strong of an opinion. You can't, and all these things that journalism has wrapped itself in with its journalistic ethics have hobbled it to the point where it is not useful anymore in this type of rhetorical environment. You know, it wasn't until the very end when like Acosta and these guys started taking chip shots at Kaley, you know, during the press conferences. It's like, they should have been doing that from day one. Like, why let somebody lie and then move on? That's insane. If somebody lies, you stay on it and everybody gangs up on them until they, you know, get into it. And they'd act like, it's a lie, let's move on.
And the interesting thing is, since I know a lot of journalists, you know, they know better. Mm-hmm. You know, outside of their official capacity, they'll talk about, you know, what a, you know, liar Kaley McEnany is, or whatever, whoever the person is. But yet when it comes to covering that person, the norms of journalism, as you said, have not changed to keep up with the times.
Yeah, they're hobbled. And I'm like, those are really smart people. I would trust their read on things. I want to hear it. I don't want to hear, you know, hobbled journalism that somebody else is using for, you know, effect.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things I think with academics, like we should, I think, assert ourselves and say, hey, the environment has changed. Rhetoricians are nothing if not adapters. You know, it's the whole Aristotle, every available means of persuasion. You see, it's grown up like, great, I'm going to jump over here and be like, hey, I'm going to retrain the journalists. So like I did a joke pretty early during the Trump thing about just give the journalists little signs. Everybody's got a sign and it says liar. And every time they lie, the whole room, you know, holds up the sign, and there's your new visual. And it's, you know, it completely changes the dynamic because that's what they're all thinking.
Yeah. But they're, you know, in very somber tones trying to respond with, well, that's not what you said yesterday, Mr. President.
Yeah, not, they should be like, hey, fuck you. That's, you didn't say that yesterday. Like even the whole, you know, like this, oh, don't use normal talk in journalism. Like you guys have got to crack open the egg because you're going to get used and abused.
Yeah, it was, the New York Times could never move away from calling him Mr. Trump. And you think of any publication that had the right to sort of drop some of its norms, New York Times certainly did. Well, you know, I mean, you and I talked about this years ago. I mean, journalism back in the 60s and 70s was trying to change with new journalism. And,
yeah.
And yet that's, you know, you can find it in some online places and things like that, but it has not infiltrated the mainstream at all.
Yeah. Have you ever read Hunter S. Thompson's eulogy for Nixon?
Yeah.
I mean, that's journalism. Like he talked about a guy who eviscerates somebody. That's what I want from my journalist. You know, somebody who's he, and he had covered him for years. He knew everything about him. He knew everything that you'd want a journalist to know, and just tore into him with the most intense language and imagery and all the things that you want from a really good, you know, rhetorician or writer, you know, or journalist. I want somebody out there vetting these assholes because I don't get to go sit in the room. You know, so it's fascinating. So you've actually worked within politics in North Carolina. And to me, like a lot of the things, when you look at the GOP's current playbook, a lot of it comes from sort of the Jesse Helms, you know, tradition of like really sort of unethical, hardcore, stain the other person politics. And he was using that back then, you know, way back. But they were in the minority. There was only a few here and there that were going all the way to the dark side. But now it's been imported into the whole party where they'll all use this slander and libel, you know, but you remember.
Yeah. Helms. I mean, and it's a very subtle, I mean, Trump didn't do it subtly, but I think a lot of what you see coming out of the Jesse Helms tradition is very subtle. I mean, the ad that most people refer to is the two white hands crumpling up a piece of paper and throwing it away. It's a job offer. And saying in the background, well, I didn't get the job because the black guy got it. And so this was a 1990 TV ad created by someone here in North Carolina that I know. But yet, you know, Helms stayed in office, but then it started being imported to other places. And now it is the coin of the realm. I mean, it is... You know, racism is the kind of language of politics now. I mean, you saw what happened in the South Carolina Senate race. I mean, everybody thought Jamie Harrison, he was going to compete against Lindsey Graham, and Lindsey Graham smokes him by 10 points. Well, it wasn't a subtle campaign. And so, you know, you're just seeing that. And that's what I think is another task for rhetoricians is how do you combat the kind of racial appeals that are being made that, you know, because it, you know, Democrats sometimes just respond with horror. Well, that was racist.
Right.
That doesn't move the needle, as that old cliche goes. But you're right. I mean, North Carolina sort of perfected some of those techniques. Helms was not afraid to insult his colleagues. He'd go after Republicans. You know, I don't know if you remember this, but you know, Jesse Helms sort of came out of the entertainment world too.
Oh, he
was one of the first, he was one of the first editorial speakers on television. The local, what was then the CBS affiliate hired him way back in the 50s to do a 3-minute commentary at the end of the evening newscast.
Really?
And so And so if you go back and watch some of the clips, I mean, some of his classics are, he would attack the university system here in North Carolina. And, you know, he had a particular way of referring to UNC, what UNC stood for. But anyway, I mean, so for years he worked for that TV station just doing 3 minutes of blistering.
So he had good, yeah, he had, and a lot of those guys are super talented. Rush Limbaugh, you know, all these different, you know, right wing, you know, commentators. They are amazing on camera, amazing voices. They can handle script. They can do emotion. Like they are highly talented people.
So by the time, you know, Jesse Helms gets into politics or Rush takes it nationally, you know, they have got the shtick down.
Well, and he was a character, so, man. You had to give it like he was an entertaining asshole to watch. You know, if it wasn't for the lack of ethics and the horrible things he was getting into the world, they're interesting to watch.
They are fascinating to watch. And even toward the end of his life, you probably recall this, he and Bono, the U2 singer, developed quite a relationship.
I didn't know that.
And this, well, it, surprisingly, Jesse Helms supported money to Africa for AIDS. You would not have thought that, but he had some really weird, contrary positions, I should say. So anyway, he and Bono became very close at the end of Helms' career, life actually, because of the AIDS issue.
Well, and a lot of those guys, like I've worked with, you know, some of the biggest talent in Hollywood, you know, as far as speaking talent and like comedians and things like that. They're incredibly charming people, incredibly delightful, you know, and I think that a lot of the politicians, people don't really understand is, especially now, they're, you know, they're mouthing scripts that are handed down to them from the GOP, from the, you know, think tank down into the politicians, to the media. And they're just script readers, really, you know, they're talent and they're good at it, you know, but it's, they're charming people.
Yeah. And the really good ones like Helms, not only develop their skills, you know, in the entertainment world, but, you know, when they go on the campaign trail back in the pre-COVID times and do these 25 person events and can make the material fresh to a group that they, you know, same script over and over and over again, but keep it fresh. You know, it is really good to see a politician, even one you disagree with, who is really good at it.
Yeah. And I watched this with Lindsey Graham in his little, you know, impeachment talk, where, you know, he kind of, you know, sideswiped Trump just a little bit, saying he's a consequential president, even though I think he's done some things wrong. But I was watching like, oh, there's the real Lindsey Graham. Look at all the talent right there. You know, he sort of turned it all down during his election because he was trying to, you know, go up a different avenue emotionally with, you know, he was crying on camera and he's like, you know, they've got all this money against me. And he was taking that victim thing, which the GOP loves to use because it's
right. It's
empathizing with a victim for people who feel like victims. And so it's that's a strong piece of rhetoric. But then once he won, he went back to like very well-spoken, very engaging. And you're like, oh, there he is.
Yeah, he's been a remarkable person over the last 4 or 5 years in terms of being able to get out of his persona and get back into it so quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought one of the most amazing performances is during the Kavanaugh hearings when he just literally went berserk. And yet, you know, with that very short time period, he could come back into that Southern genteel persona so easily. And you just, on one hand, you're just shaking your head. On the other hand, you're just admiring that.
When you see a really good actor, and that's what these guys are, it is fascinating the way that they can completely, you know, lose who they are, lose what, you know, what you know is there and become this other thing. And not just in a way of like, but like completely inhabit that character. And you're starting to see again, I think, you know, that's getting more and more imported over as a necessary component of making it in politics. And I'm not sure the left has really, you know, seen that yet. It's done on the right, you know, and again, so when you don't have the ethical restrictions, acting in sort of politics is an unethical technique. You're supposed to be who you are, talking about your honest views on the world so that we can predict you and know who to vote for. But the right doesn't use that. They're like, you know, I'm going to act however I want in order to get this vote.
What's interesting is one of my side gigs is I do polling, and every election season I always ask a series of questions, what voters want. And the word authenticity appears close to the top of all the qualities. And yet what you and I have been talking about, you know, it's one of those things, they say they want authenticity, but that's not what they want. They want somebody who performs. You know, that's the question. Maybe a generation or two ago, they had a better sense of it. But I think authenticity today means what's closest to what I need at the moment. Mm-hmm. So it's authentic with my feelings, not authentic with, you know, traditional like consistency and things like that.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. There's a comedian in the South. There's a lot of big characters in the South that the rest of the country doesn't know about, but they've been making $1 million a year doing stand-up forever. But there's a woman named Etta May, and she bills herself as the Arkansas housewife from hell. She's actually an Italian Brenda Ferrari, which probably isn't even her real name, but she's from Iowa. And she's playing a character. She has a fat suit on, she has a costume, but she never breaks character. And she's been doing this for 30 years. Everybody thinks that that's who she is, you know, and the South is like, yeah, she's so good at it. It plays authentically. But, you know, again, that's what a really good actor does, is they can easily portray an authenticness that a lot of people can't pierce, you know?
Yeah.
Like you're clearly being an actor here. You're not a nice guy. I know that. And you come across.
Well, you know, you pick up a few things studying politics over time.
So tell me a little bit more about working in politics, like coming from academics over into politics, because it's something I never really worked in politics. I got interested in, you know, sort of breaking the stuff I do from rhetoric over into politics because of Trump and MAGA. But I'm looking to sort of, you know, understand that world more and like trying to actually have an effect on it. What's been your experience there, like taking from academics over into people who are actively doing politics?
Well, for many years, I ran campaigns, and so I was in charge of message and all the other things with campaigns, and I'd work for candidates that I generally agreed with or liked as a person. And to your question in just a second. I got out of that 15, 16 years ago when one of the candidates asked me, what should I believe? Like I was supposed to give them their issue positions, not make their issue positions more palatable.
Sure.
And I said, are you kidding me? And she said, no, I don't know what to believe. You need to tell me. And I said, okay. I couldn't deal with that sort of, you know, and you said it well, it's a performance. I mean, she was a good performer. She had a lot of skills with people, particularly interpersonal skills. But, you know, it was interesting working with some politicians. I worked primarily with, from the state level on down. I never ran a national campaign or anything like that. But, you know, even statewide candidates, they're smart people. I mean,
yep.
You know, you don't become successful. I didn't work with some of the people that, you know, we could obviously mention that may not be smart, but the people I worked with, law degrees from good schools, good professional backgrounds, they weren't invested in issues. I mean, you know, I laugh now when I see politicians who talk about principle, and when I now see the Republicans talking about, well, we've got to talk about the debt now after 4 years of not caring. You know, it's... I think a lot of people that I've seen now in politics, I mean, it's a cliche to say this, but they are driven by the power. I mean, I'd like to think, you know, when I first started working with politicians in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, these were sometimes school board candidates who just could get into a dissertation with you about curriculum matters that would make your eyes cross. So, you know, there were times where I worked for people who just simply needed to be able to translate that passion and knowledge to the everyday person.
Good wonky government people, right? Because that's what
I mean, really a real bureaucratic sense about them. And just over the time, I've sort of run into too many people. There's an organization here in the state that trains candidates, and they do a good work, but I used to work with them, and you know, it was the same sort of thing. You get somebody who had a lot of talent. I mean, just a lot of natural ability. And yet you could tell, you know, one day you said, the Democrat could win this race, they'd be a Democrat, and a Republican win this race, and they'd be a Republican. And I just went, wow. So it's a tough field. And
so was that morally unnerving to you, or was it intellectually unnerving to you?
It was both. I mean, sort of when the person first told me, what should I believe? That got me on many levels. I mean, it was just like, okay, have you not thought about this? Have you not read? Because one of my things, this is my academic training. When I first would sign on with a candidate, I would produce all these policy papers, policy briefs on every imaginable topic. Because I just thought, you know, you cannot go out there in front of a crowd and not be able to answer a question about.
Right.
And, you know, some of them made a half-hearted attempt to read it. Some of them did a good job reading it, but it was just sort of, I quickly moved away from that. But the moral thing was tough too. I mean, to find that, you know, there are people out there who just simply will say whatever they want. I mean, you know, I see Ted Cruz, speaking of someone in your state, you know, he's, you know, number one in his class at Harvard.
No, he wasn't. That can't be true. That is absolutely not true.
Well, anyway, it may not be, but.
Can't be. Absolutely impossible.
On how he performs. But I happened to be at the Republican National Convention in 2016. And the most, you will appreciate the entertainment value of this. So, you know, leading up to that, he and Trump had been going back and forth, and Trump had insulted him, and Cruz had called him whatever he called him. Cruz is giving his big speech in Cleveland outside the arena. So he had probably a couple thousand people there, and he was, you know, how he can get going. Trump helicopter picked him up at the airport. He buzzed Cruz. I mean, he was probably a couple hundred feet above Cruz in the crowd, so he just completely drowned Cruz out. It was the most amazing performance. And you would have thought that, you know, that Cruz would have just lost it and just gone after Trump's throat. He was in the convention all that night. I mean, he didn't come out 100% behind Trump, but it was, you know, he's already insulted his wife, his father, and buzzed him at a at a convention speech, and he's supporting crazy. Trump at the convention, whatever.
Well, like one of the guys that I interviewed from Hollywood is a showrunner buddy of mine named Eddie Feldman, and he ran Dennis Miller. And so he's used to dealing with, you know, crazy and with politics. And one of his other jobs was he was the head writer, executive producer of storylines for WWE. So he would come up with the big story arcs and all that stuff for wrestlers and for these massive, you know, wrestling events. And same thing, you know, like when you're starting to do entertainment politics, you need big signaling. And that's why, like, something like that with, you know, going after somebody's wife, saying your dad was working with Castro, you know, buzzing people with helicopters, you're just looking for heightened conflict. And again, Trump, you know, having come from Hollywood, knows that it does not matter what the conflict is, doesn't matter what the ethics of it are or anything else. And that's what eventually tripwired Trump, is the whole Capitol insurrection is too big. It's too visual. You can't overcome that rhetorically. You know, before it was like hidden phone calls and stuff like that, going after other politicians and saying nasty shit and all that. People are like, yeah, that's small, scuffle, forgettable stuff, even though it's horrible, you know, for real, like Putin and that. But when he did that big, you know, insurrection and you got all those visuals on TV, I don't see how the GOP comes back from that, because that's going to stain them forever. Well, I mean, yeah, I just see it's too big a signal. It's too big.
Yeah, it's huge. But, you know, to watch some in the GOP, like Hawley, continue to sort of, I mean, not completely disavow that and not completely push Trump away is just mind-boggling. I mean, it's almost like you're so involved in your audience I mean, whatever, your MAGAs, you can't step back and see, you know, that's one thing's rhetoric is always impressed upon me, the study of rhetoric is you've got to completely understand your audience and not just the narrow segment of your audience. You've got to understand your, and that's where I think, I think Trump is done. I mean, I don't think, you know, he runs 4 years from now, no matter what the Senate does. No, I think right. The signal was too big, but you know, it's these other people who are relatively new in their careers. You're going, I don't see it.
Yeah, it's an odd choice. And I get it. I mean, there's enough political energy behind the anti-hero, you know, which is essentially all this is from a narrative perspective. Yeah. For the, you know, for the this whole thing to go, okay, I can still stay in that energy. That audience isn't going away. It's enough to, you know, elect me and maybe take me up to the national level. I get the calculation of it. And especially if you drop the moral or ethical components, which clearly politicians, especially at the national level, are just fine with and really good at, you know, I would have a, if you have a conscience, you know, people are going to see it. And like, it's a handicap for a rhetorician at that level. So I see him move over there and you're starting to see, you know, they're trying to break down the evilness of the big signal, the insurrection, like even saying, you know, we deserve to be there and nobody was really hurt. The fact that people died and the guard died, if somebody hadn't died, they'd probably be able to skate past it.
Yeah, but the fact that, you know, it's not just the five or six, depending on how you're counting it, people died, but the, you know, the visual had them attacking police. You know, that's, you're exactly
viciously,
right.
Like pounding is, and
I mean, that's, the signal is too dramatic. But, you know, to disavow the visual that we have, increasing the amount of visual evidence that we have, you know, I probably get asked more often than not in the last couple of days, what do you think the Congress is going to do to its own members? And like, will they expel Hawley and Cruz? And on the House side, we have a North Carolinian who's kind of a ringleader. And I said, that's the interesting rhetorical challenge. You know, will McConnell, who's an institutionalist, is his calculation, you know, get rid of them and perhaps piss off a certain segment of the base? Or can you deal with the firestorm that...
Well, they've made that, right? I mean, that's the right has become, and see if you agree with me on this, the, you know, the Tea Party, like it started with Gingrich and the Contract for America. Yep. They radicalized the party into an obstruction party. They went farther over and grabbed the Tea Party people because they were good, you know, big signaling visualists and all that constitutionality warped rhetoric, you know, around that. They allowed it all in. They allowed the evangelism, which had always been in there, to kind of grow. And so they made a pact with it. And the thing that I know for sure that when you adjust to the crazy doesn't just, you know, sitting in its chair where you allow it, it takes over. And so it's taken over. And now like Hawley and these guys, they don't have anything else. They can't be traditional conservatives, austerity rhetoric, you know, that kind of traditional values, that's gone from their, you know, major platform. You're starting to see they try to pull it back up with like this, like the debt, you know, that's austerity rhetoric. It's just hobbling rhetoric to try to keep the Democrats from having, you know, any resources. Yeah. But they've done that for a long time, but that was the core of the party. And now it's shifted over to this other, you know, third has become the two thirds. And I don't know, like McConnell can't just put that back in a bottle.
No, but the danger on the other side is to do exactly what you said that Trump did. You keep escalating, and eventually, you know, a Trump, a Cruz or a Hawley has his own January 6th. You know, they get so over the top that, you know, even the crazy, many of the crazies go, that's too far.
That's too crazy for us. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to watch, and I'm curious as to where it's going to go next. Like, I do think it played itself out. I think Trump is unique. He's a unique phenomenon. He had a unique background, 40 years in the American consciousness and the media, and everybody knew him, and he was a clown. And then they changed his persona with, you know, The Apprentice to some kind of business elite, you know, guy. And then that let him in, you know, to politics. That gave him a little bit of expertise, credibility, and let him jump in. And he's good with script. None of these guys are good with script the way he was.
No.
You know, and he jumped on it and just blew it open, destroyed all the debates. Nobody could debate with him because he's great with script. You know, the very narrow type of script that he did. I don't see anybody else coming up being able to do that.
No, and that may be where the Republicans are, which is you've got an audience primed for that sort of approach and nobody able to deliver it. You know, and you kind of alluded to this, when you've got a pretty crazy group of followers and you're not living up to their expectation, they turn on you just as fast as.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a Don Jr. who is not nearly as talented as his father, you know, could be really in trouble.
Yeah.
I mean,
they'll get up and try to do that stuff and it just won't work. You know, like you even saw with, I think even Lindsey Graham and these guys, they can't really pull off that script, you know? So it's not like when he was doing his grievance politics, it's like, you know, everybody's just kind of like, this is uncomfortable.
Yeah. Not nearly as uncomfortable as Mike Pence, but.
Well, Pence is a great example of a guy who, you know, very traditional Republican, very, you know, just wrote in on the Christianity and the sort of measured, you know, hate, you know, keep it, like you said, keep it neutral language, keep it subtle so that you can't see it too much. But, you know, he can't handle the kind of Trump venom. Like those guys pick it up and it just takes them. They can't even come close to talking like that.
No.
So I think, you know, it'd be interesting to see, like, if the Democrats go and poach next time from entertainment. Like I'm not sure Kamala is the answer. You know, I think millennial politics are interesting, and we'll see if there's enough energy behind that to actually elect a president. But I would go and get Tom Hanks or somebody.
Do you think he's got he's got the star appeal. I was going to ask you that question, who you think out of the entertainment world, maybe a little younger than Hanks, would be sort of, I hate to say Trump-like, but has some of the skills that Trump has and be able to translate it into politics. Because, you know, a lot of the names that I hear sort of periodically whisper like they're interested in politics are kind of people that are long, I think, not appealing to the current Democratic base.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Tom Hanks is interesting. I bring up Tom Hanks in my class and I kind of get a lot of quizzical looks.
Yeah, they don't know who he is. Yeah. Yeah. Really?
Did he just do a movie or something with somebody, a co-star, a actress who said that she didn't know who he was?
Yeah, there's a lot of that. And he is too old, you know. The problem is, like, you know, in Hollywood, you've had that sort of super moralized leading man for a long time, you know, like your Henry Fonda's and your Jimmy Stewart's and those kind of guys. Even Reagan, you know, sort of came from that kind of background as a dramatist. And you kind of had the Martin Sheen, you had, you know, Alec Baldwin, but they're too rough around the edges, you know, to sort of slide into the fully moralized leading man. So I'm not sure if there is somebody like that. I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right that the Democrats need to learn from what's going on for the last 5 years and try to adopt some of the rhetorical strategies, but you've got to also have the right person. It's I'm thinking about the next crop of Democrats who are post Biden. I mean, you've got some, you know, I just can't think of anybody who just kind of.
There isn't, right? Like, I mean, and it needs to be Still for America, for this, you know, racist base America. It probably still needs to be a young, virile male, you know, white would be preferable. Like the fact that Biden got elected just because he fits that, you know, super traditional, non-threatening, like he's even non-threatening to racists. You know, yeah. they recognize, like, yeah, he's an old white guy. At least I got that. I'm not, you know, yeah. I'm not too scared of him, even though he likes LBQT and, you know, LBGT and, you know, all these different things. He talks about, you know, good talk about the liberals, but yeah, he's still a white guy.
Well, the Democrats, and particularly in 2018, 2020, when they went for white males, they had a sort of model. They wanted to get somebody who was a vet. So like the guy up in Pennsylvania who won in 2018, here in North Carolina, we ran a guy for the U.S. Senate who's, you know, mid-40s, had served in, I think, Afghanistan. And everybody felt sort of about him. I mean, he had some other issues too, but you know, again, I think it's just the Democratic leadership sort of, they say in certain districts we can run, you know, the AOCs and the Tlaibs and people like that. But when we get to a big statewide race, particularly a purple state, we've got this model in mind. Because here in North Carolina, the other candidate running for the Democratic nomination for Senate was an African-American woman from the northeastern part of the state. Really progressive, and all the money came in for the white vet, and he ends up losing to a vulnerable senator. So, you know,
You know who I like? I think Stacey Abrams would be a really interesting national candidate for president, because I think she's got a little more aggro power. I really like Kamala, but I think she's confusing in some ways to people with the sort of, you know, East Asian, like, mom and the black dad. And Stacey Abrams is something like, even the racist will give it up to a really hardcore, you know, in your face, not going to back down black woman, you know, and she,
particularly has, somebody, you know, who produces results.
Yeah. I mean, she's got some pop, man. I'm watching her for the next, you know, and well-spoken and all that kind of stuff, can handle script. It'd be interesting to see. I'm curious.
Yeah, you might be onto something. She might be the hope, because, you know, because the bench is a little thin otherwise.
Well, and you've seen it, like, I think Beau Biden was being, you know, groomed for this and, you know, dies. And then I think the John Kennedy Jr. was, you know, being groomed for this. And so you've lost a couple of your, like, superstar pedigreed, you know, men coming up through this, and you know, there is a vacuum for that stuff. So
yeah,
it's interesting to see what's available, but you know, I'm sure the rhetoricians will clean it all up and we'll make sure the world works right. That's
of course, if we ran the world,
that's what we do. Well, man, this is super fun. I'm gonna have you back on, because, you know, it's always fun to actually talk to rhetoricians.
Yeah, it has been a lot of fun, and I think you're doing a good thing with your podcast and with your other work, because as we talked about in the podcast, rhetoric needs to sell itself better, and its ideas are valuable.
Oh my God, like, if we would just give people, like, you know, one of my taglines for this is get 100 million people trained into rhetoric so that they call everybody out when they're using bad rhetoric, you know, just get it out of the system. I totally trust Americans and human beings in general to make decisions if they have clean discourse, you know, but I don't trust them at all if they have polluted discourse. It's a horrible system for the human brain. It's overwhelming and people can't handle it, you know?
Well, it's also, humans are unfortunately very lazy, and they fall back on patterns of behavior and talking points. If we can get them just to break out of their talking points and actually have conversation, to use actual, I hate to use this term, authentic rhetoric, or as you like to say, ethical rhetoric, I think the world would be a better place.
Yeah. Well, you know, nobody will even listen to the podcast, so we're still fighting up big hills. But it's always fun, man. I'm having fun with this thing, so I figure, like, you know, it's got to have some value. So again, I appreciate it very much. Dave McLennan, everybody check him out. You had a blog, right? Thinking something?
Thinkingaboutpolitics.com.
Yeah. Check that out. And I always got interesting things to say, and we will come back around and talk to you again at some point. And this has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. And remember, don't mistake thinking for good thinking. We'll be back.